for downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. June is First Books Month on the Missouri Review Sound Booth. This month, we bring you four writers whose first full-length books have recently been published. On this week's episode, poet Anne-Marie Thompson reads from and discusses her book, Audiation, which won the 2013 Donald Justice Poetry Prize. Thompson's work appears in the Birmingham Poetry Review, Southeast Review, Southwest Review, and others. She holds an MFA from Johns Hopkins University and a Bachelor of Music and Piano Performance from Texas Christian University.
Siberia, 1986. Clutched in a fist of dust, a halo of dust, the truck ramshackled up the road from nowhere, from some other nowhere, and as if all this were written down, written in dust, and to it you shall return. As if we made a mark on any map at all, pulled over to my father and me, and he, familiar, leaned out the window saying, come, and there would be a concert at the church. I will be playing a concert at the church. And so we followed him, and there was a crowd already gathered, neighbors. Some were strangers, but like us. They were strangers, but poor like us. And we were quiet together, and the twilight was quiet. The twilight waited with us. And we all watched as he stepped down, and someone helped him loosen the locks and straps, like untethering a bear. The piano growled and squeaked as they guided it, a whisper. Richter, Sviatoslav Richter, from the radio, they said. And he sat down, and we understood the actual weight of gravity, remembered what the earth looks like, sounds like from heaven, and we were quiet together, and the man was serious as his hands were serious, bare hands, iron hands, but gentle as a man can be gentle, and he knew the actual weight of our sorrows, and we were quiet together. And when my father and I walked home, walked in silence home, we knew the heaviness of each other's hearts, the heaviness of those gentlemen hands, hard hands, and we were quiet and heard something, a coming and a going, a breath or a raising up, the whisper of a sickle, the lifting of a page, the lifting of hands. This poem is called Pianist Remembering. When the brown pelicans returned, like pterodactyls floating darkly out of heaven into the present late blue hour of the earth, any person seeing them while sitting on her striped beach towel at the Miller Outdoor Theater and listening to Clyburn play Tchaikovsky's First would have been thinking about childhood and the coldness of the moon. The first time I heard Clyburn, the pelicans had disappeared from Galveston. I was 5 years old, and my father, driving us to the Bay House for my piano lesson in Houston, turned up the radio. Outside, the gulf burned blacker and more mysterious, yet calmer than ever, blanket warm, in all its black-hot bass note mystery. I didn't know a piano could do like that, like church, like the ocean, like where we can't touch anymore. We were silent the whole piece long, almost the whole drive, and then my father pulled up on the beach and talked about 1958 in Moscow, about spaceships and Tchaikovsky, and then later, collecting tarballs with all my rocks and beach glass and shells, I thought they must be glinting pieces of another frigid world, Russia or the moon, pieces heating up with all that music and then melting off and falling from the sky. I'll always know each trill and lift, each almost rubato of that recording, my Moscow LP scratched and imprinted like a fossil from 20 years of ear-strained listening. Each day after the school bus ride, sitting cross-legged, rocking next to my parents' turntable, and years later, moving the record and player to my dorm room, tapping the cadenza for hours on my desk along with Clyburn, trying and failing to get all of that superhuman fire inside my aching, clammy hands. I don't remember how he played a single note the night I heard him from the lawn 2 years ago. Or else I have made myself forget. The way we make ourselves improvise a melody when the competition turns our fingers to ice. The way we rewind a movie to the scene before the hero has gotten old and small and human again. The grass under the towel felt like pebbles, and the pelicans felt like creatures out of time, from the past or future or both. And the sudden warmth of the night air is the only thing I'll remember or believe.
So the two poems that you just read for us are based on real musicians. And I was wondering if you could talk about what interests you about revisiting these historical musical moments.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I was thinking about that and when you and I were talking before, and when I was growing up, I played piano pretty seriously, and so I was sort of obsessed with these celebs in the music world, and so I think that it's always just been a love of mine, and probably because, one, I was a non-athlete, like all of my friends, and two, because I wasn't super diligent in my practicing, I was obsessed by these other people, like one, my friends who were super athletes, and two, these musicians who were like super wonderful. So instead of practicing like I should have been, I was reading about these famous musicians and just sort of obsessed with their lives and wanting to be them creepily, like some weird classical music groupie. And so I did just read a ton about these famous performers, especially famous pianists, and watched a bunch of films about them, and basically learned all their moves and really just pretended like I was these people. So I think that the writing about them was so natural to me later, just because I had been obsessed with them for so long, and it's just part of how I'm thinking a lot. And when I was in Fort Worth for undergrad at TCU, I was in a place that's really obsessed also with Van Cliburn, because there's that pretty famous piano competition that happens there called the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition. And so it was wonderful for me because I was surrounded by tons of people who also adored Cliburn and just celebrated his life. And I had the opportunity to work for the Cliburn for a little while. And so I was talking to people for a lot of my life about Cliburn and about what he represented as kind of an American hero. And so from then on, especially, I was really interested in what he represented as a musician and also how he kind of epitomized that time and the hope that he brought when he won that competition during the Cold War. And the other pianist that I talk about a lot in my poems is the Russian pianist Sviatoslav Richter. And both he and Cliburn are these just wonderful pianists, but also pianists who have a very distinctive style and a lot of personality and are the heroes of many wannabe pianists. And so I think I just was always interested in them and what they represented, and also imagining their lives and also how they're affecting the lives of others and their fans. So I guess just by virtue of my piano nerdity and my desire to be like other people, I think that's where the interest came from. And then since then, just thinking still about them and their work.
Is that an obsession you've grown out of?
I would have to say no. I still am not a great pianist and am envious of the greats, and so I'm still a total wannabe and creepy stalker in that sense. But so I still listen to a lot of those recordings and still, you know, hope to someday be able to play like that, I guess. And so no, I've not. Wild Geese. Through midday woods,
where sunlight played its tricks against the gravity of nature's open hand. I walked to understand my recent sadnesses, to find bleak sticks or a rough patch of earth that matched the cold and lonely scene inside my mind, that I might somehow hold the sorrow still and grasp what might have been. So set on feeling sorry for myself, and set to frequencies that crawl along the forest's lowest shelf, I didn't note for some short while the throng of geese in blocked formation overhead, like the great cart that carries stars across the sky's dark bed, both moved and ever moving, whole and part. The effortless improbability of their too perfect gesture through the air caught me so unaware that I forgot the shade I'd come to see, and knew from those bright wings, the quiet stall, the cast and tow, there's a beauty born from every fall, more striking for the distance left to go. Breaking into the church. Transformed to other bolder selves by wine and by the grove enclosing us, we laid our hands on the oak door. It gave. We were alone and not alone. Inside that diadem of stolen stained glass light, did you hear voices, hear a hymn, those lives we'd carried there with us, or those past sinners gray and heavy in the air, before you asked to hear me play? How easily the notes came back, how clear the nocturne's lines, and how my fingers shook, the keys like unremembered lanes that recognize a homebound car. I've never known a place so safe and so exposed. Something like budding vines, like grace.
So a lot of your poems either work with traditional forms or create new forms, and I wondered what you liked about working with formal elements.
Yeah, I remember the first poetry class I ever took was sort of a fluke, and maybe the best fluke of my entire existence. And B.H. Fairchild, the brilliant poet, happened to be visiting TCU, and I happened to take a class of his. And I also happened to want to write a ton of, like, really horrible free verse, and I just didn't know what I was doing. And he really encouraged me, I think probably because of the musical background. He was like, Amory, maybe you should try meter and form and some things that will make you not just put it all out there. And so I did, and that really helped early on in my conception of line and compression and putting pressure on the language in a lot better ways than I was doing, and I just didn't know how to do with free verse for a long time. So I think, you know, early on, that was so formative in my understanding of how to write that I have continued using forms. And I think that also, as I write now, depending on whatever the poem seems to want, I will use some of those same things that I started out using to learn poetry, whether that's just a loose meter or a more regular meter, whether it's a more traditional form or a more traditional rhyme scheme or something that is sort of made up but still has a pattern, more regular pattern. And I think often when I write, I won't realize that I'm writing in meter until a couple lines in, and then we'll think, huh, this is basically iambic, whatever. And then ideally, the poem kind of directs me in that way. Like, the poem will either need or want to be more regular or more repetitive or employ some kind of rhyme or off-rhyme or meter. And sometimes, I guess, I'll write a poem one way and then it won't work and I don't know exactly why it's not working. And so often I'll go back years or months, however, whatever amount of time later, and try it, just start over, but try it a little more formally or a little less formally, or just thinking about meter or form or rhyme in a different way with the poem. And sometimes that will help the poem or make the lines tighter. But I guess the ideal thing to happen is the poem just sort of will happen, and as it happens, you realize, okay, the poem seems to be going in this direction and needs this sort of structural element or doesn't need it. And so I guess it's more of a case-by-case thing now, but when I started writing poems, meter and form, especially more regular traditional form and meter, were very helpful in just helping me compress language and focus on the line, and also open up my subconscious a little bit when I didn't have to just put it all out there or couldn't put it all out there. That form was forcing me to reach back into places I hadn't before. And so that kind of pressure was good for me. And when I was really just starting out. Black ice. On asphalt, the last of it protected from sun by the Baltimore Oaks, by row houses, medical buildings. Looks like glass, like not invisible eyeglass glass, made not invisible by the underneath eyes almost shrinking, almost displacement. I grew up in a Texas town with oil the color of everything, a town the color of oil. The Baptist churches and sprawled ranch houses, once in good neighborhoods, and now in almost Mexico, and surrounded by little plastic altars to the Virgin, and cowboys with dip-singed gums, and Gulf Coast humidity like the humidity of the dance hall. A town where old money and new money are all the same because all oil. Where the men wear Stetsons with business suits, and the women wear a rabbit the first day below 70, and where one day a man, not invisible, a friend, has seen enough and takes a little boy away for oil, drives down and down to the Gulf, and he is sweating, and he is parking the station wagon on the dunes, on the red dry dunes, and fumbling with a handkerchief in his pocket with loose change and a peppermint and cigarettes, and then starts seeing things, seeing for the first time oil on the boy, and now on himself, his hands, seeing the dark, the red, and now walking into the surf, trying to wash it away in the black, almost red water until there is nothing to see. We are on a beach that day, a different beach, the boys' friends from school and Sunday school, and see nothing as we dig moats around miniature villages, find broken sand dollars and starfish arms, nothing but the red-black rainbows and water, beautiful and terrible as fire. And later, on a beach house porch, are pouring kerosene on our heels and calves and watching the tar we hadn't noticed fall from our skin, like blood-colored skin. And now, so many states later, so many minutes spread out and lost like coins spilled from pockets and turned by the tide, I can see the black ice clear as day, as black gold, which isn't clear at all. But
so the poem you just read, Black Ice, like many of your other poems, calls up differences in place. So, for example, this one particular image in Black Ice moves you from Baltimore to Texas. And I wonder how you see place informing your poems.
Yeah, I think that place is in a lot of my poems, and I think until I moved to Baltimore, I never really thought about place all that much. I think growing up in Texas, I thought I'm a Texan, and I lived there for, I don't know, 25 years, and then moved to Baltimore. And so, of course, like everybody, I guess, once you leave something or lose something, you start thinking about it more. And so I think I thought of myself way more as a Texan when I was in Baltimore than when I was living in Texas. And because it was kind of exotic there. Like, I would tell people, I'm from Texas, and that was suddenly a thing. And so I was thinking about what was different in Baltimore, because it's a very different place than Texas in a lot of ways, Maryland and Baltimore in particular. And of course, I was there to do grad school, and so I was writing all the time. And the things I was thinking about were often things from home, or how I was dealing with the changes of living over in Baltimore. And so I think I was thinking about what was different, but also what was similar. And Baltimore was really growing on me, and I just fell in love with that city, and fell in love with it for lots of reasons. But I would often think about, like, what is it about Baltimore that's so attractive to me, or that I just really love? And I don't know, still, I don't know exactly what it was, but there's some similarities between Baltimore and Galveston. And Galveston was such an important place for me growing up. We would go to Galveston all the time when I was little. My grandparents had a house there, and so Galveston being an island, of course, has some similarities with Baltimore, which is coastal. And I think that that element of a lot of coastal towns was a big draw to me about Baltimore. And just that kind of sadness or spookiness mixed with the seductive element of the water, the big, especially big water, and the mystery that was there, and the humidity in the air and all that. And so I think I was just really drawn to that, and thinking a lot about the connections between those two places in particular, the coastal places, and thinking about what that meant to me and what that meant to the places and how that connected them just innately. And so I think I was writing about it more then, because I just hadn't really thought about place much until I moved elsewhere. And then when I moved to Missouri, of course, I was still thinking about these other places, and Missouri, of course, is not coastal. And so that gives it its own personality and its own place. And so I think, yeah, like, leaving places and moving to new places and thinking about the differences there and the connections too, that has been really important to me just as a human, and of course as a writer. Audiation for a future love. It will be clear. It will be like a tune we heard as children or have always known, that echoes in our ears one later noon and makes us feel somehow much less alone. We will not sing or hum, make it too real, but think the line and cast it from the keel. It will be summer, it will be mid-June, when children's voices try to hold the light a little longer still, too soon. Too soon at 8 o'clock to turn in for the night, we'll both decide on separate winds to turn back from our doors and watch the last glints burn. It will be warm. It will be slightly damp after the long rains from the day before. We'll watch the water underneath a lamp begin to spark and wink toward something more than concrete, something more than empty stare to linger on, toward something in the air. It will be sudden. It will be a gust of wind that blows some bit of nothing, paper, out of my hand. And you, thinking it must be a great prize, will start a hopeless caper up the street, returning empty-handed to where I stand and wait, as if we'd planned it.
So that was the title poem, Audiation. Can you tell us what audiation is, and how you came across the term, and how it informs the rest of your book?
Yeah. So when I was an undergrad, and then after that living in Fort Worth, I worked as a musician and accompanied a lot of singers for both kind of like a fellowship and also just for work. And so I got to learn about a lot of super cool singer stuff that I just didn't know about. And so these vocal coaches would often say these brilliant terms, and I would try to figure out what they meant kind of by context clues method and just kind of pretend like, okay, I get what that kind of means. But audiation really stuck with me because the vocal coach was describing it to this singer as, well, audiate the pitches, like, don't forget to audiate. And I was like, is this like a breathing thing? Is this like, I couldn't really. So I did look that one up after those voice lessons. And the term is basically to project mentally the sounds before the singer's singing them. So, for example, if the singer's sight reading a new piece of music before he or she's actually realizing the notes, like actually singing them, he's audiating or thinking the pitches, like actual projection of the pitch in his or her head. So I really loved that term, and the whole concept was super beautiful for me, and it stuck with me. I mean, this was way before I was thinking about poems at all. But I guess I told myself, like, log that away, AM. And so I did. And then years later, when I was in Baltimore, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist, and she was talking to me about her practice, and she works with a lot of patients who have been through grief, or especially relationship-based grief and divorce and loss in that way. And I asked her how she knows when she's finished, like when her work is done with a particular patient. And she said, of course, something really brilliant, which was, well, once the patient can actually visualize himself in the future as a whole and single, solitary person, and once he can do that, and once that person is happy and healthy and whole, then I know my work as the therapist is done. And so I just loved that idea of visualizing, like projecting this visual image of yourself. And I mean, not just in terms of what, like the writing that I was doing, but also just in my life. I was like, yeah, that's a good thing to remember for really difficult times. And so I just loved that she said that. And then after that, I was thinking about that and the sonic kind of equivalent of the audiating and just projecting the whole into the future, out into space. And so I think that for that one poem, I was actually given an assignment in graduate school about writing a love poem. And I didn't have any person that I wanted to write that about, and I just didn't really want to write about love. And yet then all of this stuff was kind of swirling in my mind about, you know, the future and thinking about selves and wholeness. And so I was thinking about audiation as love, like projecting that hopeful whole self into the future. And as far as the book is concerned, I think a lot of the book, or maybe the book as a whole is moving in kind of an arc from searching or grief and loss toward finding and wholeness and joy or love. And I think a lot of books probably have some kind of similar trajectory. And so I think that hopefully the book is doing that and is sort of audiating its final poems in the early poems. And so I guess that's probably why I decided on that as the title. I had a different title for a long time that just wasn't working. And then ultimately I went with just that poem as the title.
What I like about your book so much is that so many of these love poems or like passionate poems are about music in a way, you know, which is really refreshing. And I know you're a classically trained pianist. I wonder how you make the move from music to words, because music is heavily influential in this book, you know, to say the least. So what's the difference to you between actually playing something and writing a poem?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot in common between the two. I mean, of course, music and poetry are intertwined in lots of ways. I'm sure that a composer of music would have a way cooler answer, and there's probably a more direct connection between the composition of a musical piece and the composition of a poem or any kind of writing. But I think there's some similarities to me, especially in like the best moments of writing, like those moments where you're just in it and everything else goes away and you're just sort of in some kind of, I don't know, ecstatic writing glow. And that does happen to me when I'm playing sometimes. And sometimes it happens when I'm sight reading and I have to be like super focused and don't really, because I don't know what notes are going to happen next. And so you're very present in those moments. And I think, you know, if I know a piece really well, that can happen too. Like the moment where the piece is just 100% of all of your focus and you're not thinking about like who's in the audience or like what's my cat doing right now, like where you're just very present and very into the art. So ideally that's where the overlap is in that ecstatic kind of moment, but that doesn't happen just all that often. And so I think the idea of creating music and creating poems or making art is also really similar in that we're always kind of trying for something impossible. Like we're trying to achieve something that's really beyond what humans can really achieve and something that's eternal or something that's sublime. And so I think music is trying to do that, and poetry is trying to do that. So there's something similar just in the way that I think about both of them as very human acts, but also human acts that are just always trying for something superhuman. And then at the other end of the spectrum, both require a lot of just work. So you're sitting at a piano and you're trying to learn a piece, or you're trying to work out some weird fingering to make this happen. And it's just a lot of work and kind of boring, but really important work that has to be done. And I think that craftsmanlike, workmanlike mentality is so necessary when you're writing poems. And that's probably where most of the time is spent, like just really serious contemplation and working through lines and words. And so, yeah, I guess all of the ends of the spectrum have some things in common, like the workmanlike daily stuff, the practice and the editing that just has to get done. And then also in those sublime moments that you just wait for and feel really happy when they happen.
Anne-Marie, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It was so fun.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast, music by Mark Catalano. Check us out online at MissouriReview.com. There you can subscribe to the magazine, follow our Poem of the Week feature, and enter our 2014 Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize with $5,000 cash prizes in poetry, fiction, and essay. Thanks for listening, and check back next week for a new episode of the Missouri Review Sound Booth Podcast.